You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded May 17th and 22nd, 2024. Well, nearly 80 years after D-Day, the world seems no nearer peace. Serial wars since, none of them arguably good, have come and come again in a pattern of what the declaration of the Soviet government on general and complete disarmament of 1959 describes as a chronicle of sanguinary wars. But is the concept of disarmament, in a time of heightened martial bellicosity, where belligerents race to develop new and terrifying technologies, and in every quarter are seen practicing and preparing for war, possible? Can there be, finally, peace in our time? Christopher Black is a Toronto-based criminal lawyer specializing in international war crimes cases. He's also an executive member of the Canadian Peace Congress. Black's writings on international law, politics, and world events appear at New Eastern Outlook, among other places. It's where I found his recent article, Peace in Our Time, Complete and General Disarmament. Christopher Black's novel, Beneath the Clouds, a story of how people acting collectively can defeat tyranny, is published by Batik Mara. Chris Black in the first half. And overshadowed by the horrors in Gaza, in Palestine's West Bank, a modern-day pogrom is being carried out by both the Israeli government and its settlers against the indigenous Palestinian population. Hundreds have been killed and thousands summarily arrested and imprisoned through so-called administrative detention measures. Denied charge, trial dates, access to either lawyers or legal remedy, all while suffering grotesque abuses at the hands of their captors. Salam Hamdan is a Palestinian political activist and social feminist from Ramallah in the West Bank. She recently spoke at UVic with Professor Martin Bunton about Palestine on Two States in Palestine, Solution or Fantasy. Salam Hamdan and Palestine's other humanitarian disaster in the second half. But first, Christopher Black and Tolling the Peace Bell in the Face of World War Next. Welcome back to the show, Chris.
Thanks. It's good to be here again. How are you doing?
I'm doing terrific. And, you know, I'm looking at my records and it says that we're about a week shy of 3 years since the last time we spoke. And what a time it's been as right. Well. I'm reading your article, Chris, Peace in Our Time, Complete and General Disarmament. And I find it couldn't be more timely. It dovetails with your more recent cautionary piece at the NEO Journal, Britain at War, The Final Warning. Can we begin, Chris, with the latter? How and with whom is the small island that once roared waging war today?
Well, Britain, as is Canada, the United States, all the NATO countries are waging war against Russia. And they seem to act under the assumption that they can't be touched, that they can attack Russia, but they won't be attacked back. But I think they're soon going to learn that that's not correct. And Russia has now warned them since the beginning of the special military operation in February of 2022, they issued a warning then, don't interfere in these operations or you will suffer the consequences. And recently they've reissued that warning, only making it more firm by calling in the French and British ambassadors and telling the British specifically that if you allow the Ukrainians to use your Storm Shadow missiles to attack civilian cities inside Russia, Britain will be struck. And you can bet your bottom dollar that will happen. And the same applies to the United States and France. Today they issued another statement to France saying that any response to them sending French troops into Ukraine on a formal basis, because they're informally, will build a military response against France. And the same applies to the United States. So further confirmation of that, they began their nuclear tactical missile drills, I think, yesterday or today.
Yeah, with Belarus. And so what's different now then, Chris? I mean, this war has been grinding on for almost 2.5 years, and the Canadians have been involved much longer than that, right back to the Maidan coup, when the Canadian embassy was used by violent extremists set on overthrowing the government, which they were successful at. Canada has been complicit in this. We've had so-called trainers in country, military personnel in very shady circumstances. That what they're actually up to, we don't quite know. I mean, if you walk, when you say Canada's at war too, Chris, you walk around on the streets, there's no indication that this country is at war with anything. Everything just seems as ever it was. What's changed to ramp up Russia's response? I mean, the same can be true of Canada as all of its allies, the States, right. France, Britain. We've all been involved with training and arming and supplying logistics and spying satellites and all in everything but word is war. So what changed?
Well, I think Russia is just getting fed up with the constant attacks and the constant threats. Canada can be hit. I read a similar article about the United States last year, and you could write a similar one about Canada. I live near the Trenton Air Force Base, which is probably the biggest logistics Air Force base Canada has. And if the Russians strike, I'm sure they might strike that base. So I'm quite near where they could hit. I'm not comfortable about that. But people just seem to be oblivious. Because the news media doesn't tell them what's really going on. They tell them Russia's losing and everything's about Taylor Swift and all these terrible musicians they keep pumping at us. So people are just oblivious as to what's really going on. They're not aware, which contrasts with the Palestinian Gaza situation, which gets a lot of press and a lot of anger generated against Israel because of its actions. So I think the Russians are just getting to the point where, since Ukraine is being defeated on the battlefield, therefore NATO's being defeated, the threats are increasing in response, and Russia's just saying, do not go there, because if you do, we're not holding back, and we've told you time and again. And yes, Canada could be struck. I mean, Putin has made reference to the appearance of the SS man in being cheered in the Canadian Parliament several times. Yeah. He did it in the interview with Tucker Carlson recently. He made a point of raising that and showing that video in that interview. So the Russians are really quite angry about Canada's support of Nazis in Ukraine and domestically inside Canada. And Canada has a history of supporting Nazis. So, yes, Canada could be a target. I don't think first in their mind is just too small to really be concerned about, really. But Canadian troops have been in Ukraine since 2014. And in the Burkett trials in Kiev, in 2015, 2016 or so, some of the evidence came out that NATO soldiers were involved in killing civilians and policemen in the Maidan events, the Maidan coup events. So that was a NATO-organized operation. Whether that's true or not, but that's the evidence, that they saw NATO American Army soldiers and officers involved with the sniper teams. They had several snipers. Some Georgian snipers said they had several sniper teams brought in to inflict that damage, to discredit the government and overthrow it. So that was a NATO operation which Canada took part in. They overthrew democracy in Ukraine, even though they claim that their values are all democratic. That's not true. And Canadian forces, special forces, have been operating there. And I think in 2015, 2016, there was a report in the Ukrainian press that I think 11 Canadian soldiers were killed and 5 or 6 wounded. I think it was when Trudeau was there, went to the front line, and they probably wanted to do an operation for him to show what they could do, but they walked into a minefield and a machine gun trap. That's never been reported in the Canadian press, of course.
Professor Ivan Kachanovsky of the University of Ottawa has written a lot about the Maidan and about the sniper teams involved there. I had him on the show a couple of years ago now, but he's been banging on this drum. David Cameron really hit a nerve in Russia talking about sending cruise missiles, which, right, for those old enough to remember, for old guys like you and me, Chris, we remember in the 1980s, the cruise missile was the issue that was set to trigger an all-out nuclear conflict between the superpowers.
Yeah, that's true. Well, yeah, and you're right, and that's what Russia's reacting against. And the British, they have a particularly harsh view of the British, because the British have been in the forefront of provoking things in Ukraine against Russia generally for years, decades, even through the Cold War. But it dates back to the, even earlier than that, it dates back to the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, when Britain spent a lot of time trying to foment trouble against Russia, break up Russia, or use Russia in as many ways. So the history of British hostility to Russia is quite long, and they haven't forgotten that. It ended up in the 1850s in the Crimean War, but and the British invasion, along with many other countries of the Soviet Union in the Civil War in Russia at that time, in 1919 through 1923 or so, 1927. And so I think it's quite likely that if Britain permits those missiles to be used, and they were used just yesterday, several Storm Shadow missiles were attacking their bases in Crimea, which is Russia. They will eventually act, and they're not going to warn anymore. They'll just act, but we don't know when they will act. But yes, well, the British Foreign Ministry and their Cameron are just—they seem to be living in the world where they think the Russians won't dare do it. That's their whole philosophy. They won't dare do it.
In your other article, Peace in Our Time, Complete and General Disarmament, you talk about your recent trip to Belgrade to a peace conference. I mean, this is something from another age, this like Bertrand Russell or something in the press here. Of course, you know, you don't hear it, but I don't think most people know that even such things still happen. Do you want to describe what the setting of this meeting in Belgrade, and especially its commemoration, which is a personal commemoration for me, not because I'm Yugoslavian or because I was involved, but it was when this program so many years ago began as a reaction almost to what was going on in Yugoslavia then. But what's the Belgrade conference about?
Well, that's an interesting point of history. Thanks for telling me that. It was a commemoration of the 25th anniversary of the NATO attack against Yugoslavia, which Canada took part in. Canadian planes, I think, flew 20% of the bombing missions over Yugoslavia. I was told by Yugoslavian Air Force General that 6 Canadian planes were shot down. That's not being told to the people either. But that was what it was about, and it was run by the Belgrade Forum for World Equals, headed by Živojin Jovanović, who was the former foreign minister of Yugoslavia and head of the Socialist Party still. And from all over the world, there were Chinese, Russians, people from Germany, France, in fact, military officers from France. I met a colonel who was a very interesting man. Africans, people from South Africa, other African countries, Central Europe, Latin America. So, and Asia. So it was hundreds of people there, and dozens of people gave presentations and several main meetings and side meetings. And there were journalists, historians, military officers, academics, lawyers like me from several places. And we all presented, and the topic was what to do about wars. How can we prevent wars? How can we hold people accountable? What can be done to maintain the peace? And when I was thinking about what to write about, I was doing research, and I came across, just out of interest, the Jack Kennedy's speech in 1961 advocating complete and general disarmament, which followed on the Soviet proposal by Khrushchev made in 1959-60, arguing that the same thing should take place. And Jack Kennedy picked up on that. And in 1962, the Soviet Union presented a draft treaty for complete and general disarmament. And I read that, and it was very emotional to read it, because it would make you cry to read that document now, because it sets out in very concrete terms and steps how the world could disarm. And it's not just nuclear disarmament. It means, by complete and general disarmament, it means complete and general disarmament across the world. Every country would be reduced down to security forces just for local, security, internal security. No country would be allowed to have spend money on forces which would be used, could be used outside their own borders. And no weapons of any major impact could be used or built.
Well, you know, and when you say that people today in Canada don't seem to be aware of what's going on, or that we're spending all our time on social media or listening to terrible pop music, in Kennedy's speech of that time, in 1961, remember, a nuclear sword of Damocles is hanging by the slenderest of threads. That seems to be something that has been forgotten. And this is something that my generation and yours grew up with, knowing every day that any moment the world could come to an end, and that this was something that was reinforced in the press, that we did hear a lot about, that we have heard nothing about since the fall of the Soviet Union. But Kennedy said then, in a way that it might resonate to people today in another sense, but he said, I'll quote, "Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable." And for those today, they might think more of climate change and the collapse of the environment rather than a nuclear accident or a computer glitch or a madman at the controls for a moment, you know, could bring an instant end to us all.
Right. Right. And Khrushchev said much the same thing. In fact, he was more eloquent. If you read Khrushchev's speech, it's about 20 pages. I could send it to you. I couldn't include that in the article. It's far too long. And the draft treaty also, I couldn't include. Otherwise, it's there somewhere. He quoted Victor Hugo. He quoted many people saying exactly the same thing, that mankind faces extinction and a constant war unless we get rid of these weapons. So you had the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union, the two biggest powers in the world at that time, saying we have to disarm. Now, what seemed like a good idea to John Kennedy, and Premier Khrushchev, the Soviet and the American governments, seems like a good idea to me, but nobody's mentioned it since.
Yeah, that's the frightening thing, is that people, right, we're entirely oblivious, it seems. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Christopher Black. Chris is a Toronto-based criminal lawyer specializing in international crime, or war crime cases, rather. He's also an executive member of the Canadian Peace Congress. His writings on international law, politics, and world events appear at New Eastern Outlook, among other places. That's where I found the Peace and Time, Complete and General Disarmament. And, and Chris's novel, Beneath the Clouds, is available. It's published by Baddeck Mara, and it is, quote, the story of how people acting collectively can defeat tyranny. Well, Chris, can we change gears a little bit? Sure. To what's going on right now? You mentioned Palestine, and we hear a lot about it. We don't hear enough about it, in my opinion. Anyone who listens to this show probably thinks they might hear a little too much about it in these past 7 months of this horror that's been going on. But the horror is much more longstanding than that. There was breaking news, Chris, and I have to talk to you about the legal aspects of the ICC and its Mr. Khan, Karim Khan, the head litigant there, his announcement of war crimes charges against Israeli and Hamas officials. What's your immediate reaction, Chris?
Well, my immediate reaction is the same as some other people. Scott Ritter said that yesterday, but it's a totally political decision. The ICC is a political animal. It's not a real world court. It's not a world court. It's the court of certain nations who created it. This is why the United States, Russia, China are not members of it, and Israel, for instance. They have no jurisdiction over it, Israel, except for the fact that the Palestinian Authority in 2014 or 15 gave them sent them a letter saying we're granting you jurisdiction to investigate Israeli crimes against Palestinians in 2014 and their events then. And shortly after that, these ICC did come out with a statement, Fatou Bensouda, the then prosecutor, saying that Israel had committed war crimes, but they weren't going to lay any charges. You know, these investigations take a long time. So for several, almost 10 years, nothing was done, even though they said that. But now, because of the world public opinion, and especially the European and other countries pushing Venezuela, for instance, Khan met with Maduro. There's a lot of pressure on Khan to do something to make the ICC look good, or it's going to lose any credibility which is left of it. And so he's acted, but he only did so by also charging Hamas, which is the front and center piece. So you look at the document, Hamas is made real second. And they set out, he sets out, he only, the investigation he conducted was one-sided. He never talked to anybody in Hamas. In his statement, he says the steps he took in the investigation, he only talked to the Israelis. He did not talk to anybody in Hamas about their point of view and what happened on October 7th. And yet all the charges against Hamas are about October 7th. Mm-hmm. And it's the total Israeli version of what happened, not what really happened.
Well, there's a lot of excitement in certain quarters that this act, well, people that don't really understand the International Criminal Court, the ICC, are very excited and hope that somehow this rogue nation, Israel, can be reined in. But I wonder if the ICC doesn't distract from the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, which is the United Nations Court, which has more legitimacy and which Israel is supposed to. Well, can you explain, Chris, does this ICC case, firstly, does it, as I suspect, is it meant to distract from the ICJ case? And who is the ICJ, and why isn't anybody listening to what they have to say on this?
Well, you're that the ICJ, in the case that South Africa brought against Israel on behalf of Palestine a few weeks back, did say that there's plausible evidence that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. And yet, of course, the ICC does not charge Netanyahu with genocide, does not mention those findings. So they completely ignored the ICJ in their document. Don't refer to the mass aerial bombings, which have killed over 35,000 people. They just concentrate on the siege and the starvation. But the difference between the ICC is a court or a tribunal created by something called the Assembly of State Parties, which is a group of mainly European and other nations who decided to create it. But it's not a world court, because you can only have a world court with a world government, which is why major powers don't do it, although they use it and manipulate it, especially the Americans. The ICJ, the International Court of Justice, is a body of the United Nations under the Charter, and its role is to settle disputes between nations about the interpretation of treaties and international law. So the dispute between South Africa and Israel was that South Africa stated the Israelis, our members, signed the treaty on the Convention Against Genocide, as South Africa did, but the Israelis are not abiding by the treaty they signed, so they complained. And the ICJ, I thought the judgment was very, very weak and could have done a lot more. And I thought the argument of the South Africans was weak, because the ICJ and many other commentators, when asked, said that the ICJ did not order the Israelis to stop their operations and withdraw their forces from Gaza.
That's the original order of last January you're talking
right.
about.
Right, and they said, well, they can't do that. They have no authority to do that. Well, they do, because just 18 months before, March of 2022, yeah, just after the Russians went in to Ukraine, the Ukrainians made a complaint to the ICJ, and without any investigation, without any evidence, the ICJ issued provisional measures ordering Russia to withdraw its forces and stop its operations. And yet the South African lawyers never mentioned that. So when the court said, well, how can we order Israel to withdraw its forces? What precedent do you have for that? We said, your very decision you made 18 months ago.
Well, just last week, then the South Africans came back, and I would agree that there were rather meager orders made of Israel given the situation, especially the hundreds being killed daily at that point. Mm-hmm. The killing carries on. There was a second presentation by the South Africans saying essentially, okay, well, you guys, Israel, Israel hasn't abided by these meager orders. tougher measures must be made. And that was demanded of the court. At that point, Israel responded by threatening the court in one interpretation, as it has threatened the head of the ICC as well, in a not so veiled way, with Prime Minister Netanyahu saying, "I don't feel worried about traveling to other countries where he might be arrested, but you should feel worried about traveling, Mr. Khan," which sounds to me like a gangster making a direct threat of a judge. But at any rate, at the ICJ, what's your interpretation of what happened? What was it, a week or so ago now? A week and a bit?
Well, I mean, it's great that they're doing it. I applaud the South Africans for bringing the case. I mean, it's very good that they brought it, but they're arguing in a very, they're sort of pulling their punches. Because again, in this other request, they did not mention again the precedent that the ICJ could order Israel to withdraw its forces completely and stop its operations. Because that's what the ICJ ordered Russia to do in the Ukraine situation. But they don't even mention it.
Well, now,
Chris, I don't understand why the lawyers don't do that. That's pretty weird to me.
We're fast running out of time, Chris. But I mean, what about enforcement now? I mean, what use is any kind of court without an enforcement mechanism when Russia didn't stop either, and Israel didn't stop, and doesn't, and on the very day that they were in court, they actually accelerated their attacks in Rafah. The crimes they're committing are on a Holocaust scale, I feel safe in saying, without hyperbole.
Right.
So without an enforcement mechanism, what good is any of this? Is it other than
well, you're right. It has propaganda value. It has moral value to educate the public in a way. It's successful in some ways at that, and I again applaud them for doing that. It does bring to the mind of the people that the crimes are being committed by Israel, so it's valuable that way. I just don't think they went far enough, and they could have gone further. But as you're right, Wiz, there's no enforcement mechanism. The ICJ has no means of enforcing any of its orders. It's not a criminal court. It has no police force. It can't do anything except issue edicts, which everybody can ignore. And Israel is just defying them and saying, "We don't care what you say." So there is no enforcement. So the only thing that's going to stop Israel is Hamas and Hezbollah and resistance. That's the truth of the matter. The same in Ukraine. Negotiations don't seem to be going anywhere because nobody really wants to honestly negotiate with Russia. So the war goes on, and we risk world war in both cases because of the situation when the Israelis attacked and murdered all those people in Damascus in the embassy, and then Iran responded with the demonstration attack against Israel. We risk world war in both situations.
Triggered
instantly, just like that. It's very, very dangerous.
And this helicopter crash killing the president of Iran just the other day. There was an assassination attempt in Slovakia. There's a lot of weird things going on. But I don't think that there's, as far as I know, the funerals, the second phase of the funeral for the Iranian president is today. The investigations, I'm sure, are ongoing, and they won't say anything until after he's respectfully interred and everything. But even just the suspicion that this might have been an Israeli, some kind of a shoot down or technological interference or a bomb place or something, even a suspicion of something like that might be enough to trigger who knows what kind of cascading violence.
It could, but I think in this case, from the conversations released today, I saw on Sputnik or RT somewhere, the other two helicopters flying with that helicopter, people said that they saw it go into a cloud and didn't come out. It looks like it was an accident. The pilot, we don't know exactly what happened with the pilot, but it doesn't look like that. But the situation in Slovakia is very, very worrying. But you're right, because they now have lost their leader and they have to have elections, there's a risk that Iran could face some instability, which would go to the advantage of the Americans and the Israelis could use that to attack, perhaps. That's a danger. The Slovakian situation is very worrying because the Western press more or less applauded the attempt on Ticho's life because he's pro-Russian. And the same as when the massacre of all those young people at the Crocus concert in Moscow took place a few weeks ago, hundreds murdered and hundreds more burned and suffering smoke inhalation and badly injured by terrorists who were working for the West. There's no doubt about that. They applauded it. The Western media applauded it because it showed how weak Putin is, supposedly.
And the way the media, too, is besmirching Ibrahim Raisi, the Iranian president, killed in that crash, saying, oh, well, many people hated him, and belied again by the hundreds of thousands that have come out to honor the man in his in the parade of state.